Hi, I'm Steve Morgan, founder of Cybersecurity Ventures and editor-in-chief at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with my co-host and visionary, Jack Blunt, president and CEO at Intrusion. He's the former CIO at the United States Department of Agriculture. Jack and I are leading a roundtable discussion today on cyber warfare and cybercrime, the impact it's having on U.S. businesses and government agencies, and what can be done to defend ourselves. You can listen to the roundtable and read a special feature about it at cyberwarfare.com. Also joining us is an esteemed group of 10 guests who will introduce as we ask them questions. We know nobody likes a long introduction, so we're going to jump right in. Jack, great to have you with us today. To get started, set the stage. Cybercrime is the greatest threat to every company in the U.S. and perhaps the world. Is that an overstatement or reality?
Well, I'm glad you asked. And first of all, let me welcome all of our honored guests here. I'm glad to be sharing this conference with them. I think it's a fact, and let me give you a couple of quotes to help support that before I kind of elaborate. The World Economic Forum reports that another business gets hacked every 3 seconds of every day. The FBI, on the other hand, reports that 60% of all small businesses hit by ransomware go bankrupt. The chairman, president, and CEO of IBM recently stated, "Cybercrime is the greatest threat to every company in the world," end quote. And lastly, I'll tell you, billionaire, businessman, chairman, and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett, took the comment a step further when he said, "Cyber attacks are the number one problem with mankind, even worse than nuclear weapons." So yes, let me be very clear. I strongly believe that cybercrime is the greatest threat to business continuity worldwide today. Most companies are genuinely aware of this and worried about the possibility that their data is being stolen, or their website is going to be hacked, or ransomware is going to attack and cripple their business. And therefore, they are investing heavily in cybersecurity. However, where they're not doing, they're making the mistake. They do not rethink the situation. They think that once they put these tools in place, their network is safe. It is not. Their network is infected with malware already. What we show companies is that every business in America has malware living on it today. These companies need to implement a new layer of cybersecurity that brings AI real-time to identify and block malicious connections as they're happening, not report them after the fact. So absolutely, the problem is as bad as I said it is.
So to build on that, Jack, I'd like to turn to Dr. Chase Cunningham. He is a principal security and risk analyst at Forrester. He's the author of the book Cyber Warfare, Truth Tactics and Strategies, Strategic Concepts and Truths to Help You and Your Organization Survive on the Battleground of Cyber Warfare. Chase, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Chase, I've read your book, and truly, if any university in our country was looking for the definitive text on cyber warfare, then yours might be it. I'm going to ask you something that's very difficult, but it will really help give further context to our roundtable today. Distill your book's 300 pages into 2 minutes, if you can, and explain exactly what America's businesses are up against.
Yeah, so I think really the two-minute breakdown is that my book goes through the history of exploitation all the way back to where this was being used actually as a means of gaining an advantage in World War II. I mean, the first thing that I kind of talked about was the use of electronic warfare in the space for a thing called the Battle of the Beams back in World War II, and really got into the realities of how that is modified into this space we find ourselves in today. Jack was talking about that this is not just a one and done thing. This is a marathon, like this is a continual life cycle. I tried to break it down into the realm of reality of what is and isn't actually likely and how you should think about putting yourself in a combat mindset rather than just doing business that you happen to be on the internet. And I really think that the benefit there comes from looking at this stuff from the perspective of the adversary and the reason that they're engaged in it and why you should combat them in the manner that makes the most difference. You can't get into a ring with someone that's a better fighter than you and expect to walk away unscathed. My book was trying to make sure people are aware that this is a fight, and the way that you enter a fight is by being prepared to fight.
Well, thank you for that, Chase. Next up, we have Mark Montgomery. He is the executive director at the United States Cyberspace Solarium Commission. The CSE was established in 2019 to develop a consensus on a strategic approach to defending our country in cyberspace against cyber attacks of significant consequences. You can learn more at solarium.gov. Mark is also a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Mark, welcome. Thank you for joining today.
Thanks, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
I'd also like to point out that Mark is a retired Rear Admiral. He spent 32 years plus serving our country in the U.S. Navy, and would like to thank you for your service.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
So, Mark, the problem that U.S. businesses are faced with is clear and frightening. The Commission published a report which was presented to the public earlier this year, and it offers hope for a better tomorrow with regards to cyber defense. What specifically does the report say to C-suite executives at America's largest organizations, which is one of our focal points today?
At first, I caution Steve that we have a great report on cybersecurity about every 5 years. And if we had 80 recommendations, I'll bet somebody can claim authorship of 70 of them from a report 5 years or 10 years or 15 years ago. In fact, I worked at the National Security Council in 98, 99, 2000 on counterterrorism and critical infrastructure, working for Dick Clark. And some of the same things we're recommending today are things that we were pushing 23 years ago. So a little bit of caution there. But thanks for your kind comments about the report. What I'll say is, you know, when I think about senior executives, I think what you can read in our report is the idea that risk is increasing. And I look at it two ways. The two big drivers of risk are both increasing exponentially. One is the availability of tools to malicious actors. That's increasing exponentially, and the quality of those tools. And the second is the interconnectivity of our systems is increasing exponentially. So two of your risk drivers are increasing exponentially. Your risk mitigator investment in cybersecurity is at best linear, maybe the slight upslope. So to kind of any, you know, I'm a nuclear engineer in the Navy, to any kind of engineer, when your two risk drivers are increasing exponentially and your one risk mitigator is increasing linearly, you probably have a risk of high consequence occurring. So when we talk to senior executives, you know, coming out of the report, we really talk about investing in security, and we're really talking about resilience, the idea that if and when prevention fails, what's your mitigation and your recovery plans? That's where I think, you know, the real, you know, headspace needs to be applied. And, you know, senior executives know this, but it's across people, processes, and technology. Anyone telling you they have the one piece of gear, either hardware or software, that's going to solve it is probably selling you, a Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, it's really, you have to make those investments in people, and you have to make those investments in processes. I would emphasize that, you know, it's fair to say that if basic cyber hygiene processes are followed at your workspace, as well as in your home environment, you know, the idea about multi-factor authentication, harder, you know, difficult passwords, and not responding to any request from a Nigerian prince for some support, you know, no phishing. If you follow those three basic cyber hygiene practices, your processes will be more effective. And kind of when we wrap it up, we have to ask, are you getting what you need or what you desire from the U.S. government in collaboration? The answer is generally not enough. And so we have a lot of recommendations on how to fix the government on that. And then our final advice to the CEO, and this came from Tom Fanning, who was himself a CISO, is that you really need to listen to the CISO in those discussions. He or she is going to bring you what appear to be, you know, it's hard to see the return on investment decisions for you and the board to make. And sometimes you do have to make those investments up front to prevent the kind of cataclysmic damage down the line. That's the kind of discussions that the Solarium report kind of generates, you know, our commissioners have with the C-suite, Steve.
Well, I appreciate that, Mark, and we have some distinguished CISOs with us today, and we'll hear from them shortly. The former White House CIO, Teresa Payton, is with us today. Some of you may know Teresa for her role as Deputy Commander of Intelligence on the CBS reality TV show Hunted. She's also the author of a new book, Manipulated: Inside the Cyber War to Hijack Elections and Distort the Truth. She's one of our nation's top cybersecurity investigators and experts. Teresa, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you. And I'm super excited to be here with all of my wonderful colleagues.
So Teresa, the name of your book says it all, and it's very scary. This affects every person in our country and in so many ways our businesses. The manipulation that you write about has to do with elections and being manipulated about much more. Give us a synopsis of hostile nations versus the U.S. and what's at risk for American businesses?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because obviously our democracy across the globe is at risk right now because of these misinformation and manipulation campaigns, many of which, but not all, sort of conducted by nation state operatives. And so I actually do, similar to Chase did in his book, a little bit of a history lesson of, guess what? This isn't because of social media that we suddenly have misinformation and manipulation campaigns. Pretty much is documented since there were two human beings walking the earth. We've had some type of propaganda or manipulation campaign. So I give everybody a little history lesson. The reason why I do that is I became interested in these because I saw American businesses and certain industries actually have huge reputation risk based on misinformation, manipulation campaigns. We don't have time to get into all of those today. But they are impacting global elections, the U.S. elections included. And I really felt strongly I wanted to unveil what was going on with these campaigns. I actually found an American hacker who actually conducted a misinformation and manipulation campaign in America that didn't get caught. And I have a whole chapter dedicated to his operation. But really, I wanted it to be a masterclass to make sure that not only what our thought process is as we go into a voting booth or vote remotely and how we do that, but also around protecting businesses from these campaigns. And so it was a real honor to be able to finally get the book project together and get it out there and, you know, hopefully help people. And I always say to people, maybe you don't need the book, but chances are your family and friends do. So if you've got somebody who annoys you on social media, that's who the book is written for.
Well, thank you for that, Teresa. Let me turn to Scott E. Augenbaum. Scott, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here, Steve.
A lot of you know Scott. For anyone who doesn't, he is a retired FBI Cyber Division Supervisory Special Agent. He spent more than 22 years at the FBI, and now he's a consultant, speaker, and author who continues to help U.S. organizations. Scott, I want to ask you about the healthcare industry because it is so important to our nation, and healthcare providers and hospitals are under relentless cyber attack. Ransomware in particular has wreaked havoc on hospitals and even recently led to the first human death. Scott, can you zero in on healthcare for us? Exactly how bad is cybercrime?
Well, Steve, great question. And thank you again for having me here today. I've been retired for 3 years from the FBI. I spent 29 years with the FBI, half of it spent working cybercrime issues. And I hate to say it, the issues we're dealing with today are no different than they were in 2004. And during my time in Nashville, which is the Silicon Valley for healthcare organizations, which we have 500 healthcare companies, I've had the opportunity, unfortunately, to deal with a ton of victims. During my career, I must have interviewed at least 8,000 victims of cybercrime. I thought 2014 was going to be a game changer in this all when we started seeing targeted attacks from the People's Republic of China getting in for the first time, actually stealing healthcare information. It's not the first time they got in. I mean, anyone in the government knows they've been getting in for years. And then about the same time, we started seeing, and I thought that was going to be a game changer, but it really wasn't. And then we started dealing with ransomware issues in 2015. 5 years ago, within the FBI, we put out a great report back in 2015. And what do we see? The same issues that we've dealt with in 2015 are the same issues that we are dealing with today. And I've seen it a lot on enterprises, but it's really hitting the mid-sized companies. It's hitting the small companies. and they don't stand a chance. Because I'm going to be honest with you. I think we're not going about it right. And I wish somebody would really disagree with me. What are we dealing with when we're talking about ransomware strategies? Everyone's going, you better have a good backup. And I'm like, well, that's awesome. What does the backup do? Backs up your information. But we're not talking enough about ransomware prevention and following the core critical controls. What do all my victims have in common? None of them knew what was on their network. They weren't application whitelisting. Everybody had admin rights. And then we wonder why things continue. So what we really have to start focusing on that, as Mark said before, we got to start focusing on our hygiene. A lot of this stuff could be prevented. And I really hope organizations will really, especially in healthcare, because we have one reported death. We do not need to have any more of this. And super excited to be here and to be learning a lot from my other panelists.
Well, thank you so much for that. We have another Scott with us, Scott Schober. Many of you know Scott. He's a popular author in our industry. He wrote Hacked Again, and more recently, Cybersecurity is Everybody's Business. Scott has appeared as a cybersecurity expert on dozens of broadcast TV shows and radio programs. He's been an authoritative voice to small businesses across our country for more than a decade. Scott, welcome.
Hey, Steve. Great to be here, and thank you, too, for assembling this, and it's an honor to be around such great minds fighting cybercrime and cyber warfare. So I'm with some great colleagues. Thank you again.
So, Scott, we have several Fortune 500 chief information security officers joining us today, and we'll hear from them shortly. But first, we want to hear about the millions of small U.S. businesses who are battling cyber warfare and cybercrime without any full-time staff or experience devoted to cybersecurity. Scott Augenbaum just touched on that. It's very scary. We read about these companies suffering tremendous financial harm and even shutting their doors. What's going on, and how can these small businesses combat cybercrime?
Yeah, fabulous question. And I think I could take it to heart because I am a small business owner. We've been in business 48 years, and we've seen our ups and downs and the challenges with economies and everything under the sun. But certainly with this COVID pandemic, I think it's challenged every organization, whether it be small or large. But small businesses in particular really had to relearn the way that they operate during this pandemic. And a large percentage of their workforce really had to pivot because overnight, in a sense, we're working remotely, we're working from home. And when that's the new norm, obviously hackers are moving in to exploit any weaknesses. And we've had to adapt and adjust to these new working practices. And I think it's challenging to keep a company secure, especially a small business, when that company can be divided and located or spread over a large geographic area. Because again, it just opens the doors to untold vulnerabilities there. And that's been one of the biggest challenges. And I think we're all familiar, and we probably experienced it ourselves in our own business, the huge increase in just everything across the board, from phishing emails, they're up. Spam is increased. Ransomware, as a colleague just talked about there, increased greatly there. Even the price of ransomware, the demand is skyrocketing. And that is a huge concern for small businesses. And it doesn't look like any end is in sight. And that is a tremendous concern for myself, certainly. So a lot of these small businesses had to learn, again, virtually overnight, how do they make sure they secure their home network? Are they using a good VPN? Is their mobile device secure? Are they sharing a computer that's doing both personal and business email? And how important it is to make sure that they're implementing these security protocols. So I think it's a new game for all of us as small business owners. I think everybody's up for the challenge, and I think they're doing well overall, especially with all the help and support that is out there. But I think people really have to be leery that they don't fall victim to cybercrime on this COVID mess.
Well, thank you for that, Scott. Small businesses are a very important part of this discussion. We are going to pivot and shift to America's largest companies. Jack, we're about to introduce four security leaders from the Fortune 500. You touched moments ago on comments that Warren Buffett, the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, made. I want to read to you just very quickly a statement from him. He says, the world where people, organizations, and occasionally countries could have people that would like to wipe out a large percentage of the American people, or maybe other countries as well. And you know, they have capabilities, which I always thought until recently might classify it as nuclear, chemical, and biological, but I think you have to add cyber now. Is cyber, in your opinion, Jack, there with nuclear, chemical, and biological?
Well, as I commented earlier, I do believe it's that bad. I think cyber is and will rapidly grow to be the newest and most effective form of warfare around the world today. Everybody is connected. Nobody can afford not to be connected and do business. From credit cards to banking to insurance to healthcare, you have to be connected. You can't just be on an island. Therefore, it is the way that every cyber terrorist, every bit of cyber warfare can be conducted to every human being on the planet every day, because we're all connected and they're smart and they're using that real time to attack us, as everybody constantly says. And let me just point out, the problem is getting much worse every day. One of the reasons it's getting much worse is the technology is getting much more sophisticated. So I would tell you, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, certainly, most cybercrime attacks were done by a person sitting at a keyboard. I can tell you now that most cybercrime attacks are driven by a supercomputer using an AI algorithm, and they work 24/7, 365. They don't go to lunch. They don't go to the bathroom. They don't sleep. So they hammer you 24/7. And like all other types of AI, they actually learn every time they attack you and don't successfully get through, how to modify their attack and attack differently. So I do believe that cybercrime, cyber warfare has become this worldwide threat. I can tell you in the work that I've done with the Air Force, for example, that the Air Force shifted from not believing in cyber really at all to believing that cyber is the future of all warfare.
Well, let's move to the security leadership at the largest corporations in our country. Appreciate that feedback, Jack, and would like to hear from some very important people right now. First up, Deneen DeFiore. Welcome, Deneen. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Deneen is the Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer at United Airlines. She was previously Senior Vice President, Global Chief Information and Product Security Officer at GE Aviation. Deneen, you know as much about our nation's airspace and aircraft as anyone I've met in cyber. You help protect one of our country's largest airlines, and that includes its ground control, IT infrastructure, and all of its assets and intellectual property. What unique threats and risks are airlines and aviation companies faced with that society and even cyber professionals outside of your industry are unaware of?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities and can resonate to what a lot of companies are going through in terms of cyber events and incidents, just because of the nature of all the things we just heard. But I think in the aviation industry, we're particularly appealing target for many reasons. We have a very large customer base, or high visibility. We have high sensitivity to service disruptions, and the overall economics importance of the industry itself. Just like we heard from the healthcare examples earlier, attacks can run the gamut from disruptive attacks like ransomware and data destruction to data theft of intellectual property and even customer information. But what I think is really unique is that the aviation industry truly operates as an ecosystem with very, very complex interdependencies. And any business system that's as complex as aviation, we have to continuously wrestle with wrestle with this concept of shared risk. We really can't do anything on our own, and that translates to cyber risk. Pair that with the way that digital technologies continue to reshape the aviation industry, you know, not only from running our network and airline operations, but now considering the customer experience, right? Threats, they continue to evolve rapidly, and that increasing dependency on the ecosystem for our whole entire operations is pretty concerning, that transfer of risk. You know, I think when most people think about cyber in aviation, they think of the aircraft, and that's probably the highest risk. It is true, aircraft are becoming more enabled or e-enabled, and pilots, crew, maintenance personnel, they're increasingly connected to the aircraft in different and more complex ways, like, for example, electronic flight bags, and that presents a different type of risk that we need to address. Even passengers are expecting an increasingly digital experience, from everything from buying a ticket to navigating the airplane or airport to in flight. They're also bringing on devices with a lot more computing power than they would have done even 5 years ago. So all that interdependency and connectivity is in the pace of a digital that's, you know, digital within the aviation system, is one of those risks that we really have to manage in an industry that's, typically doesn't move as fast as the technology. So those are things that, I think about, and we define strategies on how to, move the needle and try to get ahead of those risks.
Well, thank you for that, Deneen. We've talked about healthcare and now the aviation and airline space. I want to turn to Alyssa Abdullah. Many of you know her as I do, as Dr. J. She is the Senior Vice President and Deputy Chief Information Security Officer at MasterCard. Before that, Dr. J was the CISO at Xerox, and earlier in her career held the position of Deputy CIO for the White House. Dr. J, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Dr. J, the financial services industry has been the bullseye for cybercrime for as long as I can remember. In fact, the CISO role dates back to 1994, when financial services giant Citigroup set up a specialized cybersecurity officer after suffering a series of cyber attacks from Russian hackers. Today, the budgets for just the top four largest banks in our country exceeds $1 billion. And yet, somehow, cyber intruders are entering these institutions, dwelling undetected for as long as a year at a time, and stealing personally identifiable information, incalculable amounts of money into the hundreds of millions of dollars. How does the financial services industry move the ball forward on defending against cybercrime, not to mention hostile nation states with their own motives?
I think we are moving the ball in three ways. Externally, with our government, with government partners and other industries, across our sector, with our peers, and then internally with our employees. So externally, the financial sector collaborating committees are always meeting with government agencies like the US Treasury, just to make sure that we're aligned and make sure that we are fostering innovation with all of our government partners. And so we meet a lot with Congress as well to pass any key laws that will help fight security head on. Across our sector with our peers, financial services has done a great job of ensuring all of the proper plugins at all levels within and across to defend cybercrime. So we do a lot of information sharing within our sector. Whether you are a member of the Financial Sector Security Collaborating Committee or an ISAC or the Banking Policy Institute's BITS organization, which I'm the vice chair, we actually do a lot. And that list goes on and on and on across the sector to make sure we're sharing information internally and to make sure that we are all together fighting the adversary. And then the last piece that I mentioned was internally within our own cultures and within our own environments. We're always forcefully fighting for a cyber aware culture. And at MasterCard, one of the things we do is we have company-wide threat briefings. And these threat briefings really kind of removes the sensationalism that happens a lot of times with the movies. We have an idea of what the adversary looks like and is going to do in terms of the movies and what, you know, how they presented it to us. But our actual company-wide threat briefings, they tell our employees what we are facing and the steps that they can take to help protect MasterCard. So that's our what's in it for me effect. We have employee-specific spear phishing campaigns, meaning each spear phishing test that an employee receives is designed just for them. There is, while we do company-wide spear phishing, there are specific spear phishing campaigns that are meant for each and every employee. So you can't call your teammate and say, hey, did you see that spear phishing test that I just got, because it's not the same across all of our employees. And I know a lot of my peers are doing the same and similar types of activities within their own organizations. So there's a lot being done to move the ball forward within financial services.
Well, thank you for that, Dr. J. We're going to hear from you again in a few minutes, as we will from all of our guests. Next, Teresa Zielinski, CISSP, Senior Vice President, Global Chief Information Security Officer and Product Security at GE Gas and Power. She's been with GE for more than 23 years. Teresa, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Teresa, there has been so much written in the media about our nation's power grid and its susceptibility to a cyber attack by foreign adversaries. How real is this threat, and how prepared is our country and its corporations to defend against a catastrophic intrusion like that? And how cyber resilient are we if our power grid were to actually be compromised by cyber threat actors?
Yeah, I think after listening to everyone today, I think we'd be somewhat foolish to say the threats are not real. The threats are very real. The intel supports it, and the grid is continuously attacked. So we know that it's happening. Let's kind of talk about what we've seen in the industry. So back in 2015, really was the first blackout that we saw on the grid. It did not happen in the U.S. It was in the Ukraine, but 250,000 people offline for 6 hours. So that's kind of the first attempt in the world. We saw another similar attack in the Ukraine in 2016, and then first documented attack in the US in March of 2019 with the utility company. In that case, the attack did cause a loss of visibility with the control center and the sites, but there was no power disruption. So we actively see these are happening, a lot of them looking to attack control systems and those types of incidents. What could happen, and what a lot of us are talking about now, is if we look at embedded malware, something back to the chip manufacturers. If you know, you've heard of the Bloomberg article, which is obviously in question of if it happened or not, but the big hack, and could something happen all the way back to a chip manufacturer with supercomputers that many companies use? That's very hard to take place, but obviously catastrophic and would take a long time to recover. Ransomware we've seen played out, and some of the ones that personally scare me are the attacks on our safety systems and our SIS controllers. So those are some of the bigger things that could happen. So what are we doing about it? As the regulations really in the energy industry continue to ramp up over time, there's a lot of things that we're already doing about it. A lot of these are not new. We have been preparing for it, but the risk is increasing. And if we talk about what could happen, that's where we have to be concerned and make sure we can react. Some of the utilities can operate in offline mode. So they're already looking at how to do that today. And it's been talked about today already, but the basics are key. We can't overlook those basics. There's also some advanced things we're looking at. If you look at the whole supply chain, it is very complex. The way the grid operates, few main hubs with thousands of connections to utilities, it is not easy to maneuver. It actually makes it hard for the bad guys. It also makes it hard for us to protect. So we have to understand how we look at the end-to-end supply chain across the whole ecosystem of the grid to be able to protect it. And then as I talked about the regulations, we've had the NERC SIP standards that protect the grid in the US. We have a new executive order that just went live this year with the president declaring foreign cyber threats to the U.S. electric system as a national emergency. So we know this is real. We have to continue to stay on top of it. And one thing I'm very proud of is helping to stand up an energy cyber alliance chaired by EEI, which is really across manufacturers and utilities. It helps bridge that end-to-end gap across the supply chain that we've been talking about. So I'll just end with, to me, I think it's really about, you know, three things. Do we know what's happening? So we can look at the basics and the regulations. Are we looking at strategic advances and how we can get better? And are we looking at resiliency when they do happen? Can we reduce the risk when an event occurs?
Well, we're all in this industry. There's probably nothing you've said that hasn't crossed our mind yet listening to you, Teresa. You know, it's a little chilling. And I'm sure the others on this conference feel the same way. And we'll revisit that in a little while. Next up, I'd like to introduce Dawn Capelli. She is the Vice President Global Security and Chief Information Security Officer at Rockwell Automation. Dawn is a CISSP. Many people in our industry knows that Dawn was the director and founder of the CERT Insider Threat Center at Carnegie Mellon's Software Engineering Institute. Dawn, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Dawn, you head up security for one of our nation's largest manufacturers and a global leader in industrial automation. Companies in your industry own incredibly valuable intellectual property. Is it because of that? And what other factors have made the manufacturing industry an increasingly popular target of cyber criminals and foreign adversaries?
Well, interestingly enough, a week or two ago, IBM Security X-Force released a report on ransomware. And they said that nearly a quarter of all incidents that they've responded to this year were in manufacturing. So this year, 2020, manufacturing is the sector that's been hardest hit by ransomware, just as you just said. And according to CrowdStrike's annual threat report, it's not just an increase in quantity, but it's also the sophistication of the attacks on OT, operational technology. So some ransomware is capable of actually killing industrial control system processes in addition to other processes. And manufacturing is being targeted by both e-crime groups and nation state groups. So some of the companies impacted are natural gas, automobile manufacturing, chemical companies, aluminum, food, you name it. So your question, why? Why is manufacturing suddenly being targeted? The thing is, in a manufacturing environment, downtime can't be tolerated. So availability in the CIA triad, availability is key in manufacturing. And in addition, recovering plants is much more complex than recovering an IT environment. And so the theory is that these ransomware groups are finding manufacturing companies are much more likely to pay ransomware because they just want to recover. They just want to get the keys. And so that's making us a bigger target. In addition, I think just about everybody today has talked about supply chain. That's huge in manufacturing as well, because in the past, you know, third-party risk programs in companies, they looked at information security. What is the information security risk posed by this third party? And that is how you decide how much you need to analyze the risk posed by that third party. In manufacturing, if you get components, metal, screws, things like that from your suppliers, they don't pose an information security risk. So we never really worried about a cyber risk posed by the supply chain in manufacturing. But now we have to. We had a customer that had to bring down their own operations because a supplier of their critical supplier was hit by ransomware. So their supplier couldn't operate, and then they couldn't operate themselves. And we have been notified by multiple suppliers that they were impacted by ransomware. One of them told us they would be down for at least a month. So this whole environment is changing in OT. Traditionally, IT security has matured a lot over the years. OT security is behind, but I can tell you that the OT, you know, Dr. J, you were talking about the financial sector and all of the information sharing. We're really trying to promote that in the OT environment because we need to do the same thing. Everyone is trying to figure out how to secure OT, and we might as well all figure it out together instead of going at it alone.
Well, thank you for that, Dawn. Jack Blunt, I'd like to turn to you here before we move on to our next guest. We just heard from four security leaders at four of our nation's largest companies. Listening to them, what's your reaction?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that CISOs are extremely aware of the threat that business is facing today. I think they're constantly investing more and doing more. But I think they also need to constantly be aware that the problem never goes away. It's never done. Your job is never complete. The cyber criminal, the cyber warfare attack will find a way to penetrate your forces and probably is operating inside your network today. So, I think everybody we've heard today is aware that cyber crime is getting worse. The cyber warfare is getting worse. You know, Mark Montgomery probably said it the best, that the two growth vectors for cybercrime are growing exponentially, while the cybersecurity spend is probably flat. So we're not doing enough if we understand that cyber warfare is a growing, vicious, endless warfare.
So our final guest is Joe Aiello, Vice President of Infrastructure and Cybersecurity at Teachers Federal Credit Union in New York. Teachers is a not-for-profit, member-owned institution that provides personal financial services to more than 335,000 members, and they are one of the largest credit unions in the country. Joe, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for inviting me to the roundtable.
So, Joe, the budgets at any not-for-profit organization are going to be tight and scrutinized, but they are up against the same cyber threats as everybody you listen to today. You've been a technology leader for both types. Tell us about the cyber threats that you protect against and the challenges for all not-for-profits out there.
Oh, well, good question. I guess I'm going to focus more on what's been really happening in the last year or so for us. We've seen, of course, with COVID, a rapid change on how we have to work as an organization. Prior to the beginning of the pandemic, our culture was one that, everybody more or less worked in the office. You came to the headquarters, you came to a branch. That obviously ended overnight. Our security standards were based on that principle. Almost all of our systems were on-prem. We had a very fortress model, if you will, for securing our systems. Almost all of our data was secured locally. And that's been a bit of a change over the last several months. Securing our systems have always been a challenge. And for a financial institution, we've had additional burdens to protect our sensitive data. We have to maintain our members' trust in everything we do. And today, our members, the public, are fairly well-versed on security best practices. And they'll be quick to question us when we don't use it within our technology or by our staff. So probably our largest issue facing us right now is in our transition from this on-prem model of computing to cloud-based systems. We've been starting this process about a year ago, and we really needed to change how our perimeter is secured. It is really expanded, and compounding that with the fact that now we have almost 500 people working remotely for the first time, our security perimeter has changed dramatically in a very, very short period of time. And as a consequence, we're challenged with how we keep ourselves up to date in terms of our design and how we defend ourselves. You know, for example, you know, right now we have things like our data lakes for our core, data analytics, partnerships with vendors, all of which are relatively new for us and how we secure that. One of the things that we've done as an organization is we've built a dedicated cybersecurity team with the goal of holistically building an enterprise-wide security profile into all projects from their inception. No project in our organization is allowed to start without a full security review happening first. There's been a bit of a learning curve to doing this, some initial pushback from business units for sure, because things were, in their mind, slowing down. But generally speaking, once we've educated everybody about this process, they've been supportive of it. They understand the threats all too well. And we've been able to be successful in catching what we think were major vulnerabilities before they get implemented. And that I think lends itself to obviously a better product and a better reliability and less risk, or mitigating the risk. Although after hearing what everybody has to say, I'm going to have to go back and redo most of everything that I've done because I'm scared.
Well, it's National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. It's a time to elevate the concern. We read so much in the cybersecurity periodicals. I consume the same thing that, you know, most of you all do about, you know, the products and the services, and that's really important. And there is a lot of, you know, great technology out there. But I think we really have to continue driving home the point to America's businesses just how serious this is. So we're going to circle back through our 10 guests, but not necessarily in the same order. And we'd like an observation, a commentary, a big picture takeaway from each one of you. And we'll ask, you know, to keep it to about a minute. You know, think of it as a lightning round. And I have to apologize in advance. I'm going to pick on you, Teresa Payton, because I know that you're always prepared. This is always off the top of your head just because, you know this so well. So let me start with you, your thoughts in 60 seconds from what you heard today.
Sure. For starters, old school cyber crimes are going to continue to be a challenge and a problem. And many of those can be solved through old school blocking and tackling, but innovation is going to be where the future's at.
Thank you for that. Dawn Capelli, in a minute, what would you like to share with our listeners about what you heard today?
Well, I heard supply chain a lot. I think that's huge. And, you know, we represent big companies here, but we have to think about those small and medium businesses that are in all of our supply chain. And somehow, I think as an industry, we have to come together and we have to figure out how or how can they protect themselves.
Dr. J, your comments, thoughts in 60 seconds.
So I think Jack opened it up so well for us in talking about Warren Buffett and cyber attacks being the number one problem for mankind. We need to implement a new security layer, a new layer of cybersecurity. He said it so perfectly, bringing AI to the forefront and helping using AI to help us fight the fight that is happening now and not after the fact, after something has been detected. So our systems have to be cognitive at the prevention level and not just the detection level.
Scott Augenbaum, if you can give it to us in a minute, your most important takeaway from today after hearing from everyone.
There was so much great information that I just took some notes. So here's what we got. Mark hit it off really great in the beginning. We're still talking about the same issues from 1998. Go online, look at Solar Sunrise. It was what the FBI was talking about in 1998. You're going to watch that. You're going to think we haven't learned anything at all. Jack summarized it best. The problem is getting worse. We're spending more money to keep ourselves safe. What does it mean? It means we're not doing it right. Scott and Joe talked about it. Small businesses, nonprofits. I dealt with so many victims in that area, and that's the lifeblood of this country. They don't have the money that the enterprises have. They don't have the access to all those groups. And lastly, Teresa talked about critical infrastructure. Within the state of Tennessee, I was responsible. I didn't worry about my big industry partners. I worried about my small utility grids that I had to go out to and break the bad news that they were infected by the black energy and they had no idea where to turn. Lastly, what I talk about is in my 1,000 victimizations, almost 90% of it could have been prevented. And it goes back to what Teresa brought up, blocking and tackling. It's about the hygiene. Before we go over and we do complicated things, let's make sure we're doing the basics and the fundamentals and we're doing it right.
Teresa Zielinski, you touched on perhaps the scariest and certainly one of the biggest threats to our nation. But if you can sum up in a minute your thoughts on what you heard from everybody else today on the roundtable.
Sure. We definitely heard the risks are increasing. And what's concerning is it's not just the risk, it's the impact. So I think we all know the impact really turning over to human harm when we look at OT environments and what it can do on shop floor and healthcare and the whole industry we heard about today. So my observation is really we have to think differently and up our game. So we know the as the risks increase, how do we get either more money to combat them or how do we both get more money and also think differently? So looking at zero trust type of technologies or TPM, I think there's the basics that help us with the 90%. We just have to do it. Some of the attacks on the grid I talked about, we're just not segmenting IT and OT networks. We know a lot of these attacks start out with phishing. We know 90% of attacks plus start up with phishing. So we're still talking about that to this day. So how do we do those basics? But then how do we inject some strategic things to have us think differently to prepare for a lot of the risks that are increasing?
Scott Schober, in 60 seconds, the big picture on what you heard today from our roundtable guests.
Absolutely. One standout from this great roundtable discussion is that we're in this together. I mean, statistics are important so we can quantify where we are in this battle. And sometimes it can even be overwhelming when we see the continual growth, as was talked about with ransomware. That is one hot topic, crippling hospitals, which affects lives on the line, critical infrastructure, manufacturing sector, supply chain was mentioned. But I think the key to success is sharing information, public and private sectors coming together to better share vulnerabilities and better education, as was mentioned, where we can improve our cyber stance by implementing best cyber practices throughout organizations. And cyber criminals are effectively using artificial intelligence and machine learning. We need together to embrace this technology to win the war against cyber criminals and realize we're in this together and we can win if we work together.
Deneen DeFiore, the 30,000 foot view. I'm sorry I couldn't resist, but I know you can give it to us in a minute or so. What did you hear today? And you know, put it all together for us.
Sure. So I think a lot of great themes. You know, we heard a lot about supply chain risk management, about information sharing, and back to basics and things like that. But I think if I sum it up, it's really around that technology alone will not protect our enterprises, our organizations, our company, and whether that's from our own carelessness or malicious actors, right? We have to arm people with the increased personal awareness and responsibility with respect to cyber safety that has to come into play. And you know, the world, we're shifting to a framework in the way we live and do business that each person has an increasing autonomy to do what they need to do with the information they have and the devices they have and what level of cybersecurity assurance they choose to adopt when they use that technology or information. But that also has to come again with an understanding that the decisions they make can have an impact on business outcomes or your personal financial situation, if it's identity theft or whatever that is. So in alignment with all the great things that I do every day to protect my organization, the awareness and making sure that cybersecurity is a thread that we all pull on in our personal lives and at work to make the right decisions and have the knowledge to make the right decisions really is, I think, an important one for everyone to consider.
Thank you for that, Deneen. Mark Montgomery, you shared a very important message from the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. And now I'm curious, after listening to leaders at some of the nation's largest corporations, what are your impressions?
So, you know, I like the discussion of ransomware and cybercrime a lot. I'd say it left me thinking that, you know, kind of back on what do each of us need to do? You know, what's the compact between the private sector and the public sector? Now, I think the private sector in combating this needs to do three things. Ensure that basic hygiene is practiced by employees that we talked about. Second, investing in appropriate security for IT products and systems purchased and for managed service providers and cloud service providers that utilized, you know, that the right level of security is built into those. Third, that they have a cyber insurance policy and covering these kind of disruptive cyber events. And that alongside that, they reviewed the data backup and recovery plans for critical services. If the private sector does that, I think the government's responsibility is to improve our understanding of the tactics, techniques, and procedures used to threaten the commercial private sector systems and figure out how to better share that. And second, you know, improve the collaboration. In other words, have, you know, something similar to the UK's National Cybersecurity Center. Third, establish those standards for cybersecurity product and labeling and the cloud surface certifications that, you know, we asked the private sector to do. And finally, increase the capacity of federal law enforcement. There's great people doing great things, but there's very, very little at the state and local level. And, you know, we really need to provide more assets and money to that. If we do those kind of three private sector steps, four public sector steps, those seven steps together are the key to building the more resilient networks that we've all been talking about here.
Joe Aiello, we had a lot of cyber brain power here today. What are your thoughts? Sum up in a minute for us, if you can.
My big takeaway from what so many people have said here today is all the simple things that we should and can be doing. So many of the successful attacks start with a human element, which is, you know, a spear phishing email, as Dr. Jay has mentioned. So important to educate our users on what to expect and how to expect it and to bolster those defenses for that. And the other thing that you see is how interdependent all of our functions are. For our world, especially, we deal with so many external vendors to help supply the technologies and solutions because we don't build them ourselves. So our online banking platforms and our different platforms are outside vendors. And those outside vendors, we're dependent upon them and what they're doing in terms of their cybersecurity piece of this. And how do we as an organization drill into them and understand what they're doing so that it doesn't affect us? So those are the big things.
So Jack Blunt, I'd like to turn to you to close things out. But before I do, I want to thank you. I've been listening to you, not just speaking to you directly, but I've been reading some of what you've put out, not just from Intrusion, but over the past few years. And you've helped me look at this from the perspective of American businesses, and we're under attack and we're all in this together. You know, we tend to elevate things in our industry. Yes, it is global, and we can talk global. But today, you know, we had a group of people who are leading the defense at America's largest corporations. We heard from people who are protecting our smallest companies. So I want to thank you for elevating that. To close out the roundtable, after hearing from all of our guests, what are your thoughts?
Great comments by everyone. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate. You know, I have a math degree and I'm a numbers guy, and I've been in this industry for 42 years, so I have a lot of experience. Yes, everything is growing and on the uptake. Cybercrime is out of control. Yes, 56 million phishing emails are sent out a day, according to the federal government, a day. But, and again, numbers. People talk about blocking that their various tools may do today, but most sites that do blocking block somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 bad IP addresses. At Shield, we know there's 6.8 billion active IP addresses on the internet every day. And guess what? 3.2 billion of those addresses are evil. They are bad sites. We know, we've indexed them, we've tracked them. So yes, the problem's huge and getting worse, but I would like to leave everybody with a thought of hope. I believe with artificial intelligence and the brain power that we have in this conference today, cybercrime can be brought to almost zero within 3 years. If we just step up, relook at the problem, understand that today, while we think we have a clean network, it is infected right now while we're talking. If we rethink the problem, then we rethink the solution. I believe we can stop cybercrime. That's why I'm at this company. That's my mission, to help businesses protect themselves.
Well, it's a joint mission for all of us, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today. Cybercrime Magazine will be publishing a special feature on today's roundtable at cyberwarfare.com. And we're also going to be receiving some written submissions from our guests, so there'll be more to it than what we heard. Thank you all again. I'm Steve Morgan, founder of Cybersecurity Ventures and editor-in-chief at Cybercrime Magazine. My co-host and visionary was Jack Blunt, president and CEO at Intrusion. To learn more about our sponsor, Intrusion, visit intrusion.com. You can listen to the roundtable and read the special feature about it at cyberwarfare.com.